So why don't we then begin, without much further ado, with the first paper. And so I think Kenny is our first summarizer. And so why don't we have Kenny get up, or in whatever format you like, and describe what your main points are, and our authors prepare to respond in general.
Publication, where and the example that they cite in this particular context, which I think is very very important, is Chris Demos' project, where it is possible for students, for undergraduates, for our students, and those with whom we work, to contribute to that with a very sort of basic format and schema for contributions. There's no reason why students can't contribute to that, and Chris provides an excellent illustration of that. And then finally, the third aspect that they talk about is the cataloging and indexing processes as scholarly activities and contributions. And this, you know, it is, I think, people have long noted that the creation of a critical text is something that stands as one of the great achievements for classical scholars. But when you stop to think about, I don't mean to in any way take away from the accomplishments of people who do critical editions, because they are great. But much of what goes into a critical edition is the type of indexing and cataloging that Chris and Tom refer to. And what we find in these sort of printed versions of these scholarly editions is really the culmination of a long process of a very basic scholarly activity. We're in a position today where we can attribute those contributions more than they were. We're in a better position now than we ever have been to do that sort of, lack of a better term, one that I've heard, sort of micro attribution, where we can actually we can identify and we can attribute the work to smaller parts of that large scale academic endeavor. And I want to add to that the whole notion of markup as part of that scholarly activity, because essentially the creation of the format of a critical edition it involves that, and there's no reason why the process of going through a text and providing these scholarly annotations in the form of tags can't be recognized as a form of a transition or a transformation of a critical edition into a critical edition that's going to actually support scholarship in the future. In addition to Demos, the article talks about this project underway at the University of Houston and at Holy Cross and at Furman of creating these editions as represented in the apparatus criticus in Allen's Homeric Iliads, the type of broadly distributed work that a whole host of undergraduates and graduate students and faculty members at all levels can be engaged in contributing to. There's also, of course, the massive undertaking before us of working and dealing with the information that's come from the NSA project. These are all excellent examples of very large-scale projects that many people can contribute to. I want to expand on their work, and I'm almost finished here. Just a couple of things. They note that the traditional sort of essay that we assign our students to write is a difficult at best and problematic assignment, because students frequently don't have the sort of background and the discipline to make a strong argumentative essay, to write one. Then they frequently don't have access to the background materials, the primary and secondary sources. And the article does have some very strong proposals and suggestions about scholarly citation that would benefit students that would appear in the work that we might produce that might have ongoing significance for students as they read that material. But I want to emphasize the other thing, and that is about, I think the size is an issue too. Because somebody, I'm just thinking of my own experience, when we think in terms of what we expect our students to do, it's very frequently couched in terms of something of a particular length. And I do think that this is another place where we can make a difference. If we can show that three paragraphs, one paragraph of significant scholarly represents significant scholarly activity, if we can say, if we can recognize that, in other words, we can get away, break away from the notion that student work has to be of a particular length, and look at it more as a process and as a product, I think that we would all be, all stand, we all, that would all contribute to what we're thinking to do. And I'm thinking of so often, you know, things that are readily accepted in our own scholarly conventions, things like notes and letters and smaller forms of scholarship that we embrace, that we recognize, but we often don't encourage our students to do themselves. That again, it's not so much an essay or a project of a certain length, but if we can focus on dealing with something of a particularly important scholarly contribution. And I'm thinking one of the things that they talk about in this article is the notion of a review sort of thing, where, you know, find the sources for a particular issue. And they were talking about how problematic this is because of access to the sources. But I'm thinking even as, I mean, there is nothing wrong with finding the sources of X in Plato or in Aristotle or in any of these things. In other words, we don't need to think of encyclopedic access to all of the things, but actually just say that because when you bundle these all together, you know, find the sources for X, you find them in Plato, you find them in Hesiod, you find them in Demosthenes, then we combine these together and we have, first of all, we have a multi-authored project, and secondly, we have a cumulative sort of process that's going to contribute to these over time. So I say, you know, even if we've only got access to one author in our library, go with it. And we can mine that for all kinds of information. We can teach our new practice very important sort of scholarly procedures and approaches. So again, in summary, this article is calling for a sea change in the way we think about having our students contribute to our own scholarly activities. And it offers some paradigms and some examples of how we can get them engaged in what we're doing, what would be beneficial in terms of contributing to and expanding the range of materials available to scholars at all levels. And let me just add one final thing, the importance of this sort of multi-generational element to it. We're now at a point where, believe it or not, right, but the day will never come. We're going to be senior. And you remember all of the things that we used to say, those goddamn senior professors, that they would just get their act together, you know. Well, we're that deplorable bunch. And,
well, we're old anyway. I'm not sure if we're senior.
Okay, all right, well, we are, in spite of our fantasies about our eternal youth. We are getting to the point where we do need to think about this intergeneration out and building these kind of projects and kind of activities where people at various levels can participate and contribute to that notion. We're really building the next generation of classicists who embrace the notion of cultural informatics is going to be vital. And this is one step, one way. So, I'm done.
Gentlemen, you want to respond to your respondent, or what are your thoughts?
I fixed the abstract, which is all I wanted to make any sense. I don't know if that's a response. Something else to say.
I do think that there's this, as we're doing this, and it does, it's something that that I think would be very important for these contributions, and that is because they talk about, one of the things you were talking about, the student making an index of images from Ben to say, an index of the sort of translate or the text that exists in electronic formats, in the folios of Ben to say. I think that there needs to be a place, because I'm reading through this, and I want my students to do that too. You know, give me a book, give me 10, whatever it is. I want to do that too. I want to have my students do that. So I think it's going to be vital for these contributions to have some sort of, paragraph. If you want to contribute to this project, the images are X. Contact so-and-so. We'll get you in the pipeline. We'll we'll get you organized, we'll give you some assignments, we'll pan down. Now, some of that is in there. You do make references to the system on the whole text side, but it would be, I think, really a very important contribution if you could say, you know, what's the next step? Are you excited about these ideas? Okay, well, this is what you do. That's right. This is what you do. These things are available here. If you're interested in contributing to this project, contact so-and-so. This is the procedure and that sort of thing. Because I do think that that has the potential of really expanding what we want this to do.
I think that's right. One thing that over the next, hopefully not too many years, just defining on these images regions of interest, identifying on the images like which bit of the image corresponds to a particular scolia, just defining, you know, where is line 32, you know, on this. That's something that's going to require some knowledge of Greek, not that much. And we can all have, we'll never have to teach again, right? You get our students doing this, it'll be real and cool, and that'll be possible.
This is a great way to involve undergraduates in this work. The work that Richard Talbert and I have been doing, pointing to Max the last couple of years, the edition is going to include contextual images for each and every feature on that map. And the process of selecting those and so on was a collaborative process between an undergraduate student and Richard. The undergraduate went through the whole thing and picked out, based on general instructions, what he thought the images should be. And then he and Richard sat down and worked through them and discussed the reasons why Richard wanted one shrunk or expanded. And it was a very collaborative process, and great for the student and great for Richard. That this kind of thing can be replicated lots of times.
I think for Tom too. It's been our experience that this, like when trustees of our colleges see this kind of thing, they are delighted. They think it's just the coolest thing. They're the ones who have in their power to kill a classics department or to double its funding, you know, depending on what they feel like. And I think they really do appreciate, you know, I mean, trustees want to see esoteric knowledge, you know, and arcana. They love to see their students doing real work.
I think just the undergraduates, of course, too. I mean, you know, high school students, you know, want to get in on ground floor in biology, they're in the lab just doing assays. And it's not the sexy work of the discipline, but it looks sexy on their resumes. And, you know, smart high school kids who are interested in philology or archaeology are going to be, you know, similarly moved.
Are we talking about just the pre-professionals, the proto scholars, or I spend a lot of time teaching non-majors, students who don't know the languages and never will. Where are the places? Is it appropriate? Is it worth thinking about places to get the student who will never know any Greek beyond telling one fraternity from another?
I think there's plenty of stuff there too, and it's one of the things we do say. Sort of toward the end, that it, in a lot of ways, it's precisely the non-pre-professional students who deserve to have this experience, right? Kids go off to graduate school, they're going to get up to their armpits in philology, but it's the ones who are going to go off and run a restaurant that'd be nice to have this experience. I think it's a little harder, but...
Well, the ones who don't have the languages.
Yeah.
It depends somewhat on the project scope. Certainly, we've employed engaged undergraduates in all sorts of stuff at the center. Some of them bibliographic tasks, some of them very computational-oriented tasks, GIS, jockey kinds of stuff. We've had a whole range. I mean, we have kids who are looking at a professional career classics, and we've had people go off into kind of the GIS environmental science industry, and at least one became an artist. There are... Depending on the project and the way you're applying technology to it, there you can find ways to.
Yeah, I like those last examples because what worries me a little bit about the earlier examples is this sort of return to the 19th century ideals of what classical scholarship does. And there's so much more. There's so much more about, you know, sustained arguments. You can have your doubts about the five-paragraph essay, but there is something about the sustained argument that I value very much, and that is also going to be important to students moving on in further careers in classics or outside classics. And the sustained argument can also be, what can I do with machine learning in classical texts? What, there's so much more to do with new technology that 19th century linguists, historians, etc., haven't done. And so to feel that the best we can do for our undergrads, and I know this, I'm trying to be devil's advocate a little bit, but the best that we can do for our undergrads is to make them feel like, you know, undersized Villamontians, right? We can do better, right? And it must be clear to them that the world didn't end in the 19th century and we all started going downhill from there. And so I like the more upbeat and up-to-date examples to be added.
Can I just add to that? That's not to say, I think that you're the celebration of the sort of the sustained argument is important. And I don't mean to, my comments weren't meant to suggest that that's not viable, but I do think that one thing that is missing in that we have sort of lost track of, and this is something that administrators lament all the time. That it's one thing to generate a sustained argument. It's another thing to have enough of a command of a particular topic to actually write a sustained argument. And I think that's the thing, that one of the things that getting students involved in these other things is important to show that sustained argument is based on a huge amount of work that has not been done. Some of it the 19th century, some of it yesterday, but that are assumptions. And I'm reminded, and I just want to put this, I'll say this on the record, that one of the things that we need to look more at, I think, is the contributions of the study of material culture as well. It's in those contexts that you again begin to see this very important and significant sort of multidisciplinary approach to a discipline, where the very basic things like, you know, counting this type of pollen from that particular, late bed corn is fundamental scholarly work. And we can't make assumptions about agricultural practices unless we can count the pollen, in those things. And so making assumptions or making arguments about demography or agriculture is based on very sort of basic research that our students can contribute. So again, I think there's place to participate in all of them, but I think one of the important things is it actually gets them into the material upon which those more sustained arguments are often based.
And if I could pick up on what Penny's saying, I mean, that was my impression as well. We're not saying that you have to have this instead of what we usually do, but to use it in a way to improve what we usually do. And again, at different levels, just like Anne was saying, you know, we have different audiences that we're trying to engage, and some of them are going to be very advanced in the languages, and they can make different kinds of sustained arguments than students at different levels or who we might only see in classes in English translation, and different ways of engaging them and having them understand what we do and why we do it, to me, was the key here. And I found, quite revolutionary this idea that we should actually know our primary sources and cite them as such and let other people know how, we get there and not, use some of those 19th century. So I thought that this was actually speaking against some of those 19th century inventions, such as the collection of fragments that have become so standardized, and in graduate school were told, well, cite Jacobi, and not even told what Jacobi is or how Jacoby put his collection together. Exactly. So, you know, to me that was an incredibly important part of the paper as well, that it's incumbent upon us to show not only our students, but by implication a wider audience, how we build our own sustained arguments on these primary sources.
So I think Deimos is, well, both Deimos and the so-called Perseus overview are really two of the most important documents in classics because of their methods of citation. Because they were, the idea was to change the nature of argument. Whereas in the normal argument, if you have to look up the sources, you don't know enough to understand. You don't know enough. And if I give you sources, I'm going to give you some books that are in your library that have, and those footnotes point to other books that aren't in your library, and you'll never get to the primary sources because you're too stupid enough. You're not educated enough to appreciate this this discussion. So I think that it's this is a magnificent piece and a perfect thing. That's why we began. I opened up with it because it really captures the transformation that I mean Ross has helped drive and embody in his own career. Now I think at this point, unless we have more burning questions, we'll have this hopefully time for discussion face to face. And then there'll be, you know, obviously, we'll continue this all these conversations in various media.